From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at Stonehenge last Wednesday when two protesters arrived at the historic megalithic stone structure in England. The protesters are aligned with a group known as Just Stop Oil. They ran to the stones and sprayed dyed cornflour on several of the ancient structures as one man tried to fight them off. The protesters would be arrested and essentially charged with defacing a 5,000-year-old historic monument and could face 2 years in prison. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak called it a disgraceful act of vandalism. The protesters and their affiliated group explained that the dyed cornflour would wash away with rain, although experts were concerned that it could damage the lichen that grows on the stones, or that exposure to water could make the orange streaks permanent. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the protesters said, quote, "Continuing to burn coal, oil, and gas will result in the death of millions. We have to come together to defend humanity or we risk everything," end quote. Just Stop Oil said the motivation behind the incident was to demand the next UK government end the extraction and burning of oil, gas, and coal by 2030. Why target historic sites and museums? This was not the first time a recent protest has targeted a renowned place or a piece of art. Protesters tried to splash a can of tomato soup on Vincent van Gogh's painting Sunflowers. In France, protesters tried to pour soup on the Mona Lisa, which is protected by bulletproof glass. Those protesters seemed to hope that they could damage the painting, saying later, quote, "What is more important, art or the right to have a healthy and sustainable food system? Our agricultural system is sick because of climate change," end quote. And here's how the New York Times reported on another incident last year, quote, "For over a year, climate activists have performed stunts in museums to draw attention to their cause. They've often damaged frames and now appear to have damaged a painting too. Two climate activists struck the glass that protects a famous painting by Diego Velázquez. They delivered 10 blows with hammers, and officials said there was some light surface damage to the actual piece of art," end quote. If you're feeling like the targeting of art and historic sites is a perhaps strange thing for climate protesters to do, you're not alone. Nick Merriman is the chief executive of English Heritage, and he told the BBC that the group's tactics are saddening. He asked protesters to move their efforts away from museums and natural wonders. This week, environmental studies professor and podcaster Tyler Austin Harper wrestled with this question. He wrote in The Atlantic, quote, "If I have to pick a side, I'm with the gentleman wielding the washable dye at Stonehenge. I am an environmental studies professor, after all. But the protest left me frustrated. Yet another example of environmental activism that produces more rancor over its means than focus on its message," end quote. Harper admits he struggles with this. He writes, quote, "I find it hard to imagine that members of my child's generation will look back on the current moment and think that splashing corn dye on Stonehenge was too extreme. They may well think that none of this was extreme enough," end quote. But Harper and others have contended that climate protesters need more allies, not more alienation. And throwing a can of soup at the Mona Lisa, or hammering away at a famous painting, or defacing Stonehenge, well, that, he says, makes enemies, not allies. So what do the youngest generation of adults who are engaged in climate action in their own right, or students in local schools who are working on this, what do they make of these recent protests? What kinds of action do they think are effective? How are they trying to grow a movement that they are a part of? Let me welcome in studio, Anna Bansal is a rising junior at Brighton High School, member of the Brighton Climate Club and the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders. Anna, thank you for being on the program today.
Nice to be here.
Phoebe Martin is with Anna. Phoebe is a rising senior at Brighton High School, also with the Climate Club and the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders. Phoebe, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here as well.
On the line with us is Lola Diacentis, a rising junior at Harvard who hopes to go into environmental law. Lola, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And Jordan Schwartz is with us, a rising sophomore at Harvard studying government. And Jordan is also involved with a number of other projects we might talk about here. Jordan, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks for having me.
Lola, you and I have talked a little bit about some of these kinds of stories and frankly, about growing environmental action movements in the past. So let me just start with you, Lola, and I will ask you, when you saw the Stonehenge story, what do you make of it?
Yeah, so thank you. Thank you so much again for having me. To me, the Stonehenge thing just feels like the classic straw man argument, where you have people that have a really good opinion and a really good cause, but are just fighting the wrong thing. While I definitely, as a young person myself who worries every single day about our climate, while I entirely understand that level of frustration and just feeling like nobody is listening, I don't necessarily think that ruining historic monuments is perhaps the right way to go. In addition to studying biology and wanting to go into environmental law, I study history, and I've worked at museums, and I just can't imagine doing something like that. I just don't think it's effective. But then on the other hand, I think the question I would pose to the folks who agree with me, who don't think it's effective, is, well, then what is? Because it does appear that youth going about things in a more typical way, protesting, boycotting, lobbying, et cetera, also aren't really getting the results they want. So my question really is, what is effective?
Yep, that's a great question, and we're going to be exploring that this hour. Jordan, let me ask you for some of your opening thoughts. Go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with Lola there that just about every single one of these protesters is extremely well-intentioned. But the issue right now is less that we need people to think about it in a more extreme way and more that we just need more people to be on board. Because unfortunately for us activists, we are in the minority right now among young people and society as a whole. And so our goal really needs to be to build the movement first. And then once we have a majority, then perhaps we can get things done through politics, policy, even lobbying, and all of those methods that get policy passed, so we can actually try and help the planet in the long run.
I take that point, Jordan. Let me just follow up with one idea here. What would you say, Jordan, if those protesters from Just Stop Oil said, look, everybody thought it was spray paint, it was corn flour, it's going to wash off in the rain, Stonehenge is going to be fine, but we need to do anything we can to get more attention, even if that means showing up in places where they don't expect us, at the Mona Lisa, at Stonehenge, etc. What do you think, Jordan?
I mean, I think there's an argument to be made there, but the issue is not all press is good press when it comes to climate change and a variety of other issues on the left. And I think we've struggled with this over and over as progressives. But we need to find a way to somehow showcase our dedication to the cause and show people why it is so important, while still bringing in optimism and hope. And like, I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for what the best solution is, but I do think there's a way to do it where we bring people in and make them a part of the movement, make them believe in the cause without necessarily alienating them from the beginning.
Jordan, this would be a short show if you had the exact answer for what is going to work perfectly here. So don't worry about that. That's why we're talking. Nobody has the perfect answer for what happens going forward here. But that's why we need these conversations at length. Let me turn to our guest in studio. Anna, what did you make of that story when you saw the protest at Stonehenge?
I think the question that a lot of people are asking is climate activism too extreme? And I think that this sort of protest was very much done to bring awareness to the cause, that the cause exists, that it's a problem. And I don't know how much of that is really needed. Most Americans, I believe, have heard the word climate change. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who has never heard anything about the issue. And I think a good majority of people do understand that it's a problem. There is, however, a gap between people realizing that it's a problem and actively working towards solutions. So protests like this, although they show that, yes, it is a problem, don't really move us towards a solution any more than inaction would.
Okay. Phoebe, what do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. This protest definitely brought attention to the cause, but I don't really think it really got people on board with the cause, because it just, if anything, it just made most people annoyed. And I think I definitely agree with the idea you have to start by building up, getting a lot of people on board with the idea, and instead of just trying to bring attention to something that a lot of people won't help if they're against it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Phoebe says it makes a lot of people annoyed, I think they're just understand. I don't have a whole lot of expertise in my life. I do study how people form opinions, and I spend many, many hundreds of hours trying to work through how people open their minds and why people close their minds and what breakthroughs can happen. And I think if you just, at the surface level, I'll use the word Phoebe used, if you just annoy people, you're more likely to close them off as opposed to open them up. And Stonehenge is this renowned place. And I don't think it goes very far if people are like, if you say, well, look, it wasn't permanently defaced. It was just temporarily defaced around the solstice. I think that you might risk annoying people. And I think that that's a good word for it. But then to Lola's point, and I'll turn back to Lola, the question becomes then, so what do you do? So if hammering away at paintings or throwing a can of soup at the Mona Lisa or defacing Stonehenge makes people think, well, these people are idiots, then that doesn't help you. But you're trying to get some attention, and if there is a void of attention, a void of urgency, I could understand the frustration that says, I'll do anything to try to get attention. So why don't I start with Lola, and I'll just ask you for maybe a first thought in the series that, of conversations that needs to be had about where you go next and what is the right kind of step here? Again, it's not, nobody's got a perfect answer, but where do you start, Lola?
Yeah, so something that I'm deeply, deeply interested in is campaign finance law, as nerdy as that sounds. There is a very direct correlation between politicians who are not willing to vote for something like a Green New Deal or other progressive climate legislation on a state or a federal level, and that correlates directly to who's receiving money from Exxon, Mobil, BP, Shell, and other major oil companies. So I think that the big thing, honestly, is going to be campaign finance reform. Then, of course, the question is, how can young people be a part of that? Well, I think, again, the bottom line of fighting for campaign finance reform and making sure that our politicians can't be bought out by big oil is to start boycotting those companies directly, because if they have less money in the bank, less investments, less donations they can give, it makes it a lot harder for them to give these giant donations. Of course, taking on a big oil company as a broke college student is pretty difficult. but I think that sort of starting to target the big oil companies and specifically the donations that they're giving to our politicians at every single level of government is the most important thing that we can do.
So let me follow this point with you, Lola, and say that the idea of being concerned about the effect of money in government, money in campaigns, who wins campaigns, who gets nominated, goes back to Boss Tweed and well before, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so this is a problem that people like Larry Lessig and many others have worked on for years and years. And I say this to you as someone, you're probably much better educated in money and government than I am. And I know that you want to go into environmental law, and you're doing all this work in the policy field, and you're working alongside people in government. The concern, I think, is that every time any well-intentioned effort has been made to get money out of politics or reduce the effect of money in politics, someone finds a loophole somewhere. Someone figures out a way to make sure that those with a lot of money and power can get that influence into the halls of power. And I ask you if you are feeling pessimistic that what you just described is even plausible.
I mean, yes, to be honest, I definitely do feel a bit pessimistic about it. But I think that two things. One, we can look at the Citizens United case that happened quite recently, I think within the past decade or two. Mm-hmm. That case is a case that made this current issue that we're having with money in politics about 10 times worse. So I do think that if we can get, first and foremost, that case overturned, that's a really big step in the right direction. Of course, then you're right. This is a little bit of a problem where pessimism is quite easy to resort to, considering the fact that our Supreme Court doesn't really seem willing to take on some of these more progressive issues with the supermajority of conservative justices. To me, this is the same issue. Clarence Thomas is, hanging out with these big oil barons and getting donations as well. So that makes me think that an even more necessary step is judicial ethics reforms. And very fortunately for us, judicial ethics is actually something that connects to so many other issues, whether we're looking at the Dobbs decision, which is something that a lot of young people care about, LGBTQ plus rights and healthcare, voting reform. All of these things really do connect with the theme of judicial ethics and campaign finance reform. And I think that's something that a lot of young people forget. So I think to me, the optimism lies in the fact that we have all of these coalitions of young people who are involved in different types of activism, whether it be climate activism, women's reproductive rights, or anything else. If we can all unify, come together, and realize that there is a commonality between all of the things that we care so much about, and put all of our efforts together, I do think it's possible to get a little bit of change.
If you are able to go into environmental law like you might be intending to do, does that relate to some of what you just described? I mean, could your career work address some of those issues?
Absolutely, yeah. Campaign finance law and environmental law both fall under the bigger umbrella of public interest and public service law, which is really what I'm most interested in. As an environmental lawyer, I'm interested in taking on specific cases at local and state levels because I feel that that's where I can have the most change just with my skill set. But yeah, I think the activism around judicial reform is just as important.
One other question for Lola before we turn to Jordan and Anna and Phoebe for their thoughts on, you know, effectively what they think might be better than, say, defacing Stonehenge. I'm reading a quote, and Frank called in from Greece to say, to reference a Ruth Bader Ginsburg quote that he thinks is relevant when he looks at some of these kind of high-profile protests, the Mona Lisa thing, the Stonehenge thing. RBG said, fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. That was in response when she was 82 years old, in response to a question regarding the advice she would give young women today. Fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. And I'm thinking about maybe the wisdom of that quote. I'm also thinking about, Lola, whether you, as someone who's concerned about the Supreme Court, you're concerned about money in government, do you view her decision not to retire with any kind of frustration given the current moment, or do you think that's unfair to her?
I personally, first of all, really agree with that Ginsburg quote, and I honestly think that, not to sound like a boomer, but I think that's my generation's issue, is that we can't seem to get past this polarization of, you know, wanting it all one way or all another way. And I think that's what we see with protests on campus surrounding the issue in the Middle East as well. Young people not really being able to see past, you know, the polarization and realize that nuance is okay. So that, first of all, I do definitely agree with that. In terms of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's retirement, that's something that I've honestly think about a lot, and I grapple with myself, and I don't have a firm answer because I can really see both sides of that. So no comment for now.
Okay, that is fair enough. All right, Jordan, so if the well-intended protesters who show up at Stonehenge are maybe not helping the cause very much, and no one's got the perfect answer, what do you think is the right kind of action that's going to grow the movement to bring more of your peers in, to bring more older adults in, to bring more policymakers in? What do you think, Jordan?
Absolutely. I think the key to a lot of this, which doesn't go into specifics, is to really sell people on solutions instead of problems. And the way to do this, especially, is through supporting different policies. Like at the local level, what are the various like sub-policy levels that lead to climate and environmental progress? We're talking about transit reform, we're talking about housing reform, making it easier so people don't have to rely on cars all the time, and emit less in the process. At the same time, on a larger level, we're thinking about energy. So whether that's increasing standard renewables, investing in nuclear energy to take our reliance away from coal and natural gas, like the Biden admin's bill did a couple days ago even, but also like looking to Lola's point, trying to get it so that the people with money are at least not against us, if not actively for us. And you can see a pretty successful parallel here with persuasion on confronting NIMBYism and housing reform more broadly, where if you can persuade a small chunk of the population that does have that power through money and lobbying, then maybe that's the first step in getting larger policy progress. But then the final point here, I think, really, is just voting and amplifying youth voices. Because our generation, while not monolithic at all, is still by far the most pro-climate generation ever. And so if we want those voices to be heard and we want politicians to act on them, then we have to make our voices heard at the ballot box. If we have high youth voter turnout, then our electoral power goes up significantly, and they have to listen to us. We elect the people who support that, and they know if they want to be elected again, then they should probably listen to what the young people are saying. So if we can get youth voter turnout up in this election, not just for the presidency, but for everything there on down, for Senate races, House races, state-level races, local races, everything in politics should come down to youth voices. And if we amplify those, I think that's the first step in hopefully getting climate progress to be more broadly on the agenda.
So, Jordan, what you are touching on here, I'm sure, vexes some politicians who cannot believe at the low numbers of turnout for youth voters historically. And, you know, I mean, I guess we've seen upticks in some of the recent elections in the last 20 years, but it's still not anywhere close to older voters. And so what you are describing is this conundrum, because I understand a feeling that young adults might, the youngest adults, and again, I don't say that pejoratively, I'm just talking about age cohorts. So, you know, whether you're a teenager, you're 20 years old, you're 25, you feel like a sense of helplessness or hopelessness or nihilism, which is very dangerous, creeps in. I mean, I can understand why sometimes that is a powerful sense. But then when you wring your hands and say, well, nothing can ever change, part of what I think Jordan is saying is it sure could if you worked as a block here and actually showed up. But so it's, I don't know what the chicken and egg thing here is, Jordan, but like, how do you get more of your peers who are not voting to decide, well, I'm not going to let nihilism overwhelm me, and I will show up?
A lot of this comes down to the fact that young Americans are just overwhelmingly disillusioned right now. Mm-hmm. This is a particular passion of mine. I work with the Harvard Public Opinion Project, and we do youth polls twice a year. And so this one in the spring, we found that by far we have the lowest levels of highest levels of disillusionment, rather, in our entire polls history. Only 9% of 18 to 29-year-olds across the country that we surveyed thought the country was heading in the right direction. A lot of people thought that their vote, their voice is really irrelevant to policy outcomes, and trust in institutions is at an all-time low. So to get around that, I think the real key is we have to get hope back. We have to find some way to get people to believe that it is possible to have a better future, and that all we have to do is turn out, get elected leaders who can be held accountable and who are going to work for the common interest. And that's really hard to do, but I don't think it's impossible. That's the sort of messaging we saw with Obama in 2008, and it motivated young people in a way that you'd really never seen in decades. And we need something like that to happen again. We need young people to believe that America and the world can possibly go in the right direction on climate and a whole variety of other issues. But it's going to take a pretty big change to get there.
I have this kind of, it's not cynical, I don't think, but I have this thought that I really struggle with, which is, Jordan, you mentioned Obama in 2008 gets elected. I mean, Facebook was barely a thing. I mean, it was a thing, but it wasn't ubiquitous. Insta wasn't a thing. I mean, to say nothing of TikTok and everything else. And by 2012, of course, social media organizing was happening much more commonly, and now it's major. But I just bring that up because, you know, you bring up an election where young people felt like the future can be better. But that was mostly at the dawn of the social media age. And my concern is that so much social media activity is spreading this idea that things have never been worse, things will never get better, and that we are basically doomed. And I don't think that's healthy, and I also don't think it's true. Is my perception wrong there, or is there a lot of that you see on social?
Not in the slightest. You're completely right. Hmm. And that's probably the single biggest issue outside of money and politics, like Lola said, when it comes to actually tackling this problem at its root. We have to somehow get around some of the issues with social media, particularly in amplifying the most depressing messages known to humanity, and make it so that it's popular or even beneficial on social media to have a hopeful message and go forward with that. But a lot of that's in the norms that we as young people help spread, because let's face it, engagement on social media is driven by clicks and likes and reposts. And individually, we might not have too much of an impact. But if we can almost, at a secondary level, get young people to engage with that more hopeful content, with the stuff that promises solutions and doesn't just highlight the woe is me of the world, then maybe that's the first step in getting the rest of our generation on board to support some of those policies in the longer term.
Man, this is the good stuff. This is why our guests are here. I'm really glad. I'm really appreciating this conversation. You're hearing, by the way, that's Jordan Schwartz, who's a rising sophomore at Harvard studying government. Lola Diacentis is a rising junior at Harvard who hopes to go into environmental law. And with us in studio, Anna Bansal is a rising junior at Brighton High School, a member of the Brighton Climate Club and the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders. Phoebe Martin, same, except for Phoebe's a rising senior at Brighton High School. Anna, turn to you here. So what do you think can be more effective? What do you think can make a dent or work in growing a movement?
I agree with a lot of what Jordan has said, but while Jordan is appealing to young people here to get involved, I would also like to appeal to older Americans because they do make up the majority of voters, as we currently see, and they hold most of the wealth that can be invested, that can be used for the benefit of the causes that they care about. And I would ask them to move from awareness towards action, because I know among young people, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of want for change, and I think that's true for most generations. The young people have always led the way to an extent. But I would really like for older Americans to join us in that with their higher amounts of influence.
Let me ask you as a follow-up there. Are you hopeful that it can be achieved, or do you feel like these generational divides are really entrenched?
I think that with the care of the public in a democracy, of course it can be achieved. It's not so much a question of awareness, but a question of caring. Do older adults care enough about their future generations to get involved and to do what needs to be done? I think that's really what it comes down to. And by nature, I'm a hopeful person. I think it can be done.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. If there's more you want to share, Anna.
Oh, yeah. I'd also like to add that I agree with the premise of not necessarily only raising awareness on the problem, but raise awareness of the solutions. If I go out into the streets and I start asking people, hey, have you heard of climate change? I think I'll get some yeses. But if I start bringing up particular bills, particular solutions, particular proposals for new renewable energy plants, I think there's considerably less awareness, partially because these things are more specific and lots of them are more local, but also because I think bad news sells. It's easy to talk about the problems, and it's considerably harder to get things done and find a solution. And we've got to turn our attention toward that.
All right, Phoebe Martin, floor is yours. What do you think?
As far as effectiveness goes, I think the first step is always education. So like as Anna was saying, there's like everyone's has heard of climate change, but like when you really like teach people what's actually going on, that I think that gets more people on board, because there's a lot of people who just like go about their day. They're like, they know that climate change exists, but they don't really know specific things, like how much it's really harming the world. And I feel like just education really could like bring a lot more people on board.
Well, so in that spirit, let me ask you then, Phoebe, you're 16 now.
Yes.
What flipped the switch for you to be more involved as a teenager? What do you remember?
I just like one day, so my friend Bridget just like told me to come to the climate club. I literally didn't really know anything about climate change. I just knew that it was happening. I started like learning more about it at the meetings, and then I realized like, wow, this is a big issue. And like I've joined the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders, and I've been learning more about it in like the last year or so, and now I'm like a big advocate against.
So it was a friend of yours who asked you to just come to a meeting,
yeah,
to listen, to think about it, and it hit you pretty hard. A lot of your peers are not going to meetings. I'm not trying to denigrate anybody. I'm just observing, and so they're not as engaged as you are. There's plenty of to Anna's point, we don't have to just talk about your generation. There's plenty of American adults, period, who are not very engaged. Why do you think that is, that people are still not very engaged in 2024?
I guess I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are like, that are like me, and they just don't know. They just don't really know that much about it. And it just takes like one thing to like open up someone else's mind. Like once you like learn about it a little bit, I think that a lot more people could become interested.
Well, you know, I think that helping people learn could go a long way. I don't disagree. I also think that a big barrier here is people, and I'm sure I'm guilty of this, but there's this a feeling of inertia. There's this feeling that what is now will be in the future. What is my life like now is what the life will be like for my kids. Inertia is a powerful feeling. You know, we are built into routines and structures and systems. It is hard to think of a future in which we are seeing, I mean, not just what we're seeing now, which is literally people moving to Rochester because they're concerned about climate. That's already happening in small numbers. But I'm talking by the thousands, or parts of this country being uninhabitable, or sea level rise. I'm not trying to be doomery. I'm just like looking down the line, whether that is within a lifetime or two or three or five or even 10 or 50. We should be concerned about that. It shouldn't just be what's going to happen in my lifetime. I mean, part of what drives me kind of crazy about policy is we talk about long term, like it's 10 or 20 years, instead of thinking 100, 500, 1,000 years or more. Then you get to, if you really wanted to be sustainable, then you're showing that you really care. So I'm with you there, Phoebe, that education matters. I also think people just, it's easy to feel like what is now will be there in the future. I think your generation, I'm just observing here, tell me if you think I'm wrong, is one of the first to really contemplate hard that this inertia, this feeling that everything will just continue to be, is not guaranteed. And you're grappling with it. Are you grappling with that? Do you think about that?
Yeah. So I definitely think it's hard not to look at climate change as this big thing that's like a hopeless cause, like, because there's a lot of people that have those like opinions. I think it's important to educate people on like what could be a possibly good outcome, you know, if like, I guess what I'm trying to say is like, it's important to focus on what you can do right now to help. And like, yeah.
All right. So here's what I'm going to do. Let's get some feedback from some listeners here as we talk about our guests who are, let's see here, 16 and 16 years old in studio. They cannot vote today, although Jesse writes to say, Jesse emails the program to say, I appreciate your guest comments on the youth vote. It bears saying that today is election day. It is. It's primary election day, Jesse. Thank you. A lot of Americans don't think about primaries. Primaries is often where the winners are chosen because of gerrymandered districts and disproportionate voter rolls. So, yes, it is. It's even if there's not a ton on the ballot vis-a-vis many primary years, it is a primary election day today. So, Jesse, thank you for that. And I am sure our guests in studio are looking forward to their first voting experiences in a couple of years. Is that right, Anna and
Phoebe? 2 years.
2 years.
2 years.
Phoebe?
Like 1 year and one, yeah.
Oh, so it's coming. But I appreciate Jesse's point there. And let me get Dell on the phone before I get Art's comment as well here. Let's get Dell. Hi, Dell. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Sorry, this is becoming my lunchtime habit. It's calling in, but
no problem.
I just kind of wanted to add a little bit on the why we don't see politicians always think that they don't see as much youth investment, and I really think a lot of that has to do with the fact that every time we talk about the younger generation, we always think of them as naive or they don't know what they're talking about. And I think that there's a lot of that messaging where we tell young people like they're too young to have these kinds of opinions. And I think that a lot of the messaging on why young people aren't as engaged is because I feel like we kind of make it that way. I think we don't give them enough buy-in. We don't tell them that their opinions are as important. And I think a lot of that also has to do with the way that, we tell them the way they protest is inappropriate. And I think that kind of makes to the whole point here is that, young people, the fact that they're engaged at all is impressive. The fact that, maybe their protests are maybe getting a little out of hand. I get it, but on the same token, I think we should also look at why they feel like this is, the only way they can be heard.
So hang there for a second, Del. I'm going to kick this to Lola, because Lola, sort of half jokingly said that she felt like she had the most boomery view of the group, because she thinks sometimes her generation is, I'm going to let you describe it, Lola. It came off to me like you thought there are times where your well-intended peers protest in ways that might put people off and not draw people in. But I want to let you describe what you think, and then we'll see what Del says.
Yeah, so I think the most not to get on a really touchy emotional subject, but I think the most strong example, most salient example of that is what we're seeing on college campuses right now with the pro-Palestinian protests. Personally, I am someone who fully aligns with the idea of having a two-state solution and of ending what I personally see as a genocide. However, when we go to protest, and we see what's happening on college campuses, and we hear phrases that I view as very extreme, like, the whole there's only one solution, Intifada revolution, as one example, all of a sudden I don't want to align myself with a group that is actively, perhaps not on purpose, but is actively continuing to chant something that is harmful to other groups, and B, sort of implies violence. Yet, when these people who are leading some of these protests are approached with folks who have similar concerns as I do, their response is very frequently, well, then you're not really with our cause. And that's something that I see happening very, very frequently, where young people will have a whole slate of things a whole slate of demands within, one faction of a cause that young people care about, whether that's the issue in Gaza, whether that's climate change, women's reproductive rights, et cetera, have a very, very extreme slate of things that they want to see. And even if you agree with, say, 90% of what they're protesting, if you don't agree with the other 10%, it doesn't really, the movement isn't always inclusive of that other 10%, right? So I think that's a really big problem with BC. I think the best way I can sum it up in more simple terms is that our generation struggles with coalition building. And that's why I think, to Jordan's point, issues of voting, and to my own point, issues of campaign finance reform are some of the most important things we can push for young people, because I think that those two things, voter turnout, whether, you're a young person like Phoebe or Anna who can't vote yet, but maybe, encourage your older friends or your parents to vote, or you're like Jordan and I, you actually can vote. So youth voter turnout is one thing. And then I think the other thing is campaign finance reform, because I think that's where we can see intersections through all of these things that young people care about, with these two solutions being the most interconnected and the most plausible. So starting to unite around that, I think, is something that we really need to do a better job of.
Anything you want to add there, Del?
No, I mean, I totally take the point. Young people certainly aren't a monolith, and I think that we've all been part of those discussions where we're on board with someone, and all of a sudden they take a point where we're like, oh, whoa, okay, I was there with you. And I totally understand that position. I guess I just also think that if we take too much of this whole, and obviously I'm, many years removed from your generation still, but I feel like that if we take the position that, young people don't know how to protest, or young people aren't just because they have a few ideas that, maybe a little bit too much, we risk, discounting their entire opinions. And I think that's the saddest part of all, because, you guys are the ones that are going to change the world, not us.
Yes, I thank you for that. Yeah, I completely agree. I think something that I've heard very recently is very frequently you'll hear someone saying, well, if you want people to care about your cause, this is not helping your cause. Yet there's someone who actually doesn't align themselves with your quote unquote cause to begin with.
Right.
So yes, like I completely agree. And I think that in a democracy, in a place where we should be listening to all people, and especially in a place where we have access to social media, and can see people's opinions, even if we're, 500 miles away, I do think that even if you don't fully agree with someone, having conversations like we're having right now are really important, and you can agree with, you know, 90% of what someone says and not agree with the other 10% and still see some unity in that. So I think from an external perspective, you are absolutely correct. I think I was looking at it from a little bit of a more internal perspective of how it feels to be a young person joining some of these movements. But yes, I totally agree with you.
Del, I always appreciate the phone call. Thank you. And again, an observation I would just make, listening to the way people talk to each other and try to persuade each other, and maybe the way different generations, not that generations are monoliths, people are not monoliths. I'm trying to speak generally here, and there's always going to be exceptions. But, you know, I don't know a cohort of American history yet where, you know, the 18 and 19 and 20-year-old adults become 30 and 35 and 40, and then they look at the 18-year-olds and go, well, I don't like the way they're doing it. And it's like, I mean, this is what we talked about with Daniel Armbruster from Joywave recently on the show. They've got a new song on their album about it, basically saying that the world is you know, kind of a canvas for people to demonstrate. And we all tend to think of our own causes. But then when younger people become adults and we get a little older, we think, well, why are they doing it that way? Because we didn't do it that way. So I hear that with Dell, and I appreciate that. I also think it's valuable for movements to say, is this action productive? Is this drawing more people in? Or is it alienating? Is this effective? So I think there's a little bit of both, Dell, and that's why we're having this conversation, because I don't think people should look at Stonehenge, the Mona Lisa incident, and think, well, that's all kids these days, which is what some who want to discredit a movement will try to do. So that's why we're here. Now, I'm going to send this over to this next one over to Jordan, Anna, Phoebe. I mean, you heard Lola earlier say that campaign finance reform is huge as a solution, because the money in politics, particularly in, you know, fossil fuel money, is still very, very powerful. Art says, I'm 47. I've never been on social media. I get all my info from books and NPR. Although I will vote and keep doing what I can for the climate, I'm extremely nihilistic. I don't have much hope. So what are these solutions everyone keeps talking about? Well, Lola mentioned one. Lola is talking about real campaign finance reform, taking real concentrated money out of the campaign and electoral process that is still currently there. That's one. Jordan talked about simply getting more young people to vote, although concedes that's not an easy thing to do. But let me ask Jordan, Anna, Phoebe, if you want to add for Art's. Art's putting his hand up saying, tell me the solutions and I will back them. What else do you see, Jordan? What do you think?
Oh, where to start? When it comes to climate, there's so much to go with. And I think there are a ton of reasons that we should have hope. Not a single one of those solutions is going to solve the problem outright. And to be completely realistic, even taking every solution that could realistically be implemented together, it's still not going to solve the entire crisis. But I think a really useful way to think about climate change is less as a, is the world destroyed, yes or no, and more as a spectrum of what good we can do. Because if we do absolutely nothing, humanity will still be around, but a lot of people are going to suffer a ton. And if we take the most action possible, we can reduce that suffering immensely. So the question is, where are we going to fall in between those? And every little action we do, whether it's on improving green transportation or investing in better energy or making the transition faster from coal and natural gas and oil to all of these alternatives, every single one of those is a little bit of improvement on the margins that can make it so that fewer people die in the future, fewer people have to deal with the consequences of environmental pollutants and all of these other harmful consequences of climate change. And so that's a really good way to think about it, so it's not really all black and white, zero-sum game sort of thing, where instead we support individual solutions as much as we can, and as a result, help people one by one until we save as many as possible.
And Jordan, let me just press you to be a little bit more specific. And here's something that comes to mind for me. I'm going to talk about how things get caricatured versus how things might actually work in practice. I think it is pretty clear that eventually we have to be off fossil fuels, and eventually is probably not very far from now if we want to head off even worse sort of catastrophic consequences for maybe our generation, maybe our kids, grandkids, et cetera. And again, let's think long term. So we know that that has to happen. We're out of the infancy of energy consumption. We can be adults. We can talk about it. We know that. But some people will caricature that and say, oh, so the climate action movement wants you to do horse and buggies tomorrow. And it's like, well, they don't want you to ever leave your house. They don't want you to have a house. They want you to have a tent. I mean, like all of these things, I could probably share emails with you because people will say it. So they're going to caricature anything that moves away from fossil fuels. Although If art is looking for solutions, we got to get there. So is it your view, Jordan, that there are solutions that actually take us there that feel pragmatic? And or do you think, no, we might need some radical reworking of civilizational structure and it may be painful? Do you think we can get there without a ton of pain? How do you see it, Jordan?
Personally, I'm actually pretty optimistic on this. And I think a lot of it starts with energy and really quickly and as quickly as possible. First transitioning out of coal entirely, and then with every remaining thing once coal is gone, getting rid of natural gas. But the ways to do that are through nuclear energy, which I know is not popular with a lot of people, but modern nuclear is more clean, more safe, and more reliable than just about any other energy form we've ever created. And at the same time, scaling up solar power, because that has shown time and time again that it can beat expectations and harness this virtually unlimited energy source in the sky that exists day in and day out. From there, I think we have to talk about getting rid of our reliance on gasoline-fed vehicles. We have to talk about like what suburban architecture does for emissions and trying to revitalize a lot of our cities in that way. And so it's a lot of these solutions that individually doesn't seem like a solution to the climate crisis, but seems like a way to mitigate environmental pollution locally and maybe take the edge off overall. But if you implement them one at a time, hopefully in quick succession, I do think that is a way forward.
Adam Frank likes to say we were a horse and buggy society, and within about 20 to 30 years, there was a gas station on every corner when people couldn't imagine not being around in a carriage. So when we are motivated, we are pretty innovative. But let me ask Anna. So, you know, Art wants to know specifics here. Help Art see some specifics. What do you see?
So one specific I can give you right off the bat, because I feel very much the same way. Like, tell me what I can do. Like, don't just tell me there's an issue and leave it there. One specific I can give you right off the bat is find out about the bank where you keep your money. Where do they invest the money that you are keeping in that bank? Because many banks will, they will be using the money that is being kept in your savings account and whatnot, and they will be investing it in different corporations, in different stocks. And is it being invested in oil, in gas, in these big fossil fuel companies? Find out. And if you don't like it, change where you're keeping your money. And I know it's not an easy thing to do, but it's one concrete action that makes a difference.
Okay, Phoebe?
Solutions. I just like kind of agree with the climate action policy. Just like keep voting for people who support these like clean energy policies. And yeah.
And Anna, you want to follow up too?
Oh, yeah. I would like to say on the topic of renewable energy, I have high hopes for that. I intend to go into engineering with a focus on clean energy. And I think that as that part of society is a very creative, very innovative, and they can find solutions and get things done if they have the proper funding, if they have the research that they need, and if they have the support of the public, most importantly.
All right, let me get Robert in Fairport on the phone. Hello, Robert.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering if your panelists would be willing to sign a pledge to not fly commercially until there's a solution fuel-wise where fossil fuels are not used for flying. The other thing is, this is the generation that made Taylor Swift popular. Her carbon footprint is off the charts. I just think that there's sort of a weird dichotomy there.
Yeah, I hear that, Robert. Okay, so let me start with Lola. You're going to sign a pledge, no more flying until there's a climate solution. Lola?
I really wish I could. I will say that I live in like the Browncroft area and work downtown. I bike or take the bus every single day. I'm actually in New York City right now, and rather than having my parents and my grandparents drive me, I'm actually about to get on a bus or take a plane to go see my grandparents in New Jersey. And it's about triple the amount of time it would take to be in a car or a plane. So I'm doing what I can, yet oftentimes, unfortunately, I don't think, you know, there's no other way to get overseas unless you have, you know, like a really, really long amount of time to commit to taking a boat or something. There's no other way to get there. So I pledge that I will do my very, very absolute best to not use gas-powered vehicles whenever I can. And I pledge to continue to fight for more sustainable transportation.
Should Taylor Swift stop touring, Lola?
That is a whole other episode. We could talk about that forever.
Jordan, you're going to stop flying?
I'm afraid I'm in a rather similar situation to Lola on that, where I try not to fly much, but there are definitely times where logistically it's virtually impossible not to, when you're going between cities and especially living in a state that's different from where you're going to school. That being said, I do think that it raises a really good point on transportation emissions and trying to do our part. The aviation industry really needs to work on electric or hydrogen or less polluting versions of aircraft. And I think that's a great spot for lobbying. And it's a great spot for talent coming out of college, high school. If you're doing an internship, work with an aviation company and, you know, work on that.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think we do have to focus on like actually solving the problem on the engineering side.
All right, Anna, real quick, what do you think?
Real quick, I think that these sorts of personal choices, while they're impactful, also do reflect what's attainable in a society. So if we live in a world where the only way to visit your grandparents living in Asia is to take a plane, then we need to change that as opposed to deciding to never again visit said grandparents.
And Phoebe.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Although I cannot pledge this, I definitely will, like, I definitely already do try to do as much, like, to, as use as much clean transportation. And yeah, I think everyone should do that.
All right. So, and I'll close with this, Robert. Your question, while I don't think it's unfair, it flips responsibility on the individuals. And individual choices probably don't end up solving the climate situation. I mean, although it feels kind of cheeky in the moment to ask somebody, it's going to take a lot more than just individual choices. I've really appreciated this hour. Phoebe Martin and Anna Bansal, they're both students at Brighton High School. Thank you for sharing your first day, Anna, of summer vacation with us. Thanks for being here and sharing your insight. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Phoebe. And hey, Lola DeAscentis, Jordan Schwartz, joining us from, well, they're on summer break from Harvard, but they're doing a lot of stuff too. Jordan, great talking to you. Let's do it again.
Thanks.
Lola DeAscentis, thank you very much, Lola.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your day.
More connections coming up.